Chapter 22. Standing at the Crossroads of My Mind. Well, my foot is sore as all heck and still oozing red like a squashed jammy doughnut. Along with the backshawl fiasco, the injury has cost me a whole heap of time. With my shoes back on, that was a fun 20 minutes, I arrive at the port. It is shut. Or to use boating parlance, she is shut. Or to use pirate parlance, she be shut. The last ferry of the day taking pedestrians over the water to Gravesend has already left. As luck would have it, I'm able to hitch a lift over in a coracle. Truth be told, it's not a coracle at all. It's a small fishing boat. I've always wanted to go in a coracle, and that's why I fibbed. It's getting late in Gravesend, as it is everywhere in the UK's time zone, and with the local B&Bs either closed or full or terrible, I've got a problem on my hands. And it's not just on my hands. Sleep is a requirement for the whole body. With my mood now as black as an NHS filling, I switch from walking to trudging. I pass along a main road, through an industrial estate, under a bridge, and into a small park. I stop and look up at the star-spattered sky. I can't remember the names of the constellations, but I'm pretty sure one's named after a ride at Alton Towers. Suddenly three bullet points flash into my mind, and I'm pleased to see that my brain has ignored the default bullet, a simple black dot, and picked a slightly more stylish one, presumably by going to format, then bullet and numbering. But I also note, and this is perhaps more important, that the list offers a neat summary of my current mental state. You don't know where you are, you don't know what you're doing, you don't have any ham left. I dwell on this for a moment, and then, in what I must emphasize is a totally unsexual way, begin to lick out the empty ham packet, the few remaining drops of meat sweat, no match for the heft and power of my tongue. The hit of the saline briefly lifts my spirits, of course it does, how could it not? But then the content of the first two bullets comes to me again in the form of three additional bullets. It's true you don't know where you are, it's true you don't know what you're doing. And let me add something else, you feel isolated and alone. This is how I feel. I long for the familiarity of home, the comfort of my own bed, and, as I say, a bit of ham wouldn't go amiss either. I mean, what the hell am I doing here? Trudging the historic route of my forefather? For what? Using my eyes, I look round the park. It's empty save for a single unhomed man sitting on a bench. Another day in paradise, I say to myself, pleased that the Phil Collins reference has come to me easily. I want to think about Collins more, a lot more. But the elderly vagrant waves to me. Jesus, I think, not now. The last time I was cornered by a tramp in a park, he tried to rope me into a pyramid scheme, where you find 10 people to sell loose cigarettes and then find 10 people, and, well, I don't remember the details, but it sounded on paper like absolute guff. But still, this man is waving. Because he's homeless, I'm immediately scared. No, thank you, I say.
I wasn't asking you anything.
Pardon?
I said I wasn't asking you anything. There was no question to say no to. So why are you waving?
He shrugs.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
Ipswich, I suggest. The man laughs a throaty laugh, like his gullet needed a visit from Dinah Rod. It seems a bit weird that I just did a music reference, Collins, and now he's done one too, Beatles. But I guess it's a free country, so he's well within his rights. As a person, he's exceptionally unkempt. One side of his hair has started to form a single dreadlock, while the other is lank and fine. It's as if he's a pair of Siamese twins joined at the hairstyle. Yet something compels me to approach. If he tries anything funny, I know I can always slap him in the face, but to my surprise, his features soften. I don't mean he's melting. I just mean he now wears a kindly expression.
"Everything all right?" he says.
He has a friendly voice, and it's a pleasant surprise to meet a homeless person who isn't from Glasgow. I plonk myself down next to him, though obviously not right next to him. "Well, you know Steve Backshall," I begin.
"Nope."
That figures. "Doesn't matter," I say, and he hands me his bottle of sherry.
"Here, looks like you need it."
I'm a little thrown by this vagrant. He seems so normal. Pyramid scheme man had a way of saying, "I know not," and using the word "for" instead of "because," which made him sound like a character from Lord of the Rings or that TV series with boobs and dragons. I bet he was called something like Arador or Gondol. But this guy...
"I'm Brian, by the way. Hello, Brian. I'm Alan Partridge."
Well, I almost spit out my sherry. I had no idea I had a following in the homeless community. I'm angry at myself for being so judgmental. Just because he's homeless doesn't mean he's not capable of standing outside Curry's and looking in at the TVs. Brian had been aware of my career from way back in the 90s, when I was a sports presenter on the hard-hitting news program The Day Today. He claims I once did an interview at a racetrack in which I mistook a jockey for a child, and while I have no memory of this and doubt he's got it right, I'm touched by his enthusiasm for my canon. Footnote, not a euphemism.
"So what brings you here, Alan?"
"Doing walk in footsteps of father," I answer. The phrasing's a bit weird, but I think it might be because of the bullet point thing earlier. I tell him about the box I found in my attic, about how I'd been so certain until then that my dad was a no-good idiot, and now...
"And now the kaleidoscope's been shaken," he says. "The pieces are in flux. I get that. It's disorientating."
And now here I am in a park, going nowhere. I'm going absolutely no... He silences me by putting his fingers to my lips. They smell of cigarettes and beef crisps.
"Nowhere," he says, shaking his head. "Sounds to me like you've got a purpose, Alan. And purpose goes a long way."
God, this guy's good. I take another swig of sherry. God, this sherry's good. It's like sherry trifle, but without the trifle.
He's right. I do have a purpose.
It's funny how it can be easier to share your most intimate feelings with complete strangers than with people closest to you. I once revealed to a woman on a plane that I was still wetting the bed when I was 18. It wasn't even true. I just felt the urge to confess something because she was a stranger. Footnote. Of course she didn't know this and later betrayed my confidence by posting it online, where it's now widely regarded as fact. Every cloud has a silver lining, though, and 2 months ago I was delighted to accept the invitation to become a patron of the local incontinence charity. Conversely, I told my ex-wife Carol almost nothing. Well, not at the start. At the start, I told her everything. At the start, we were inseparable. I adored her, and she completed me. But years later, when she cheated on me with a fitness instructor and moved out, I took the decision to cut back. Footnote. First up, I resolved not to tell her things in person. Brackets, not that I've seen her since, but if I had, believe me, I would have told that which the square root of F all. Ditto on phone calls. Again, not been any, but wouldn't have said anything if there had. It was different with letters, because obviously I'd be sending those pretty regularly to beg that she came back to me. In truth, of course, the joke was actually on her. It may have appeared that I was baring my soul, and that I had to keep starting again because the tears were smudging the ink, but in fact I wasn't that bothered about winning her back. I was only really doing it because, unbeknownst to her, cohabiting worked out better for me from a tax point of view. In the end, she didn't return to me, but that's not really relevant. Yet sitting here next to this sage old tramp, I feel there's something mystical going on. I almost want to say ethereal, but I have to check its exact definition first. Here I am, or here I be, in pirate speak, in a foreign environment in the dead of night, seemingly detached from place and time, and I feel I can tell Brian anything. We talk long into the night, me about my father, he about his, passing the bottle of sherry back and forth like it's a speak ball. Footnote. Speak ball is an American counselling technique devised originally in correctional facilities and Jewish summer camps, in which a ball is passed back and forth between the offenders slash teenagers to determine who should speak. It's a hugely effective and fun way to get youngsters and or violent sex offenders to really open up. Possession of the ball gives the chat much needed structure, whilst the gentle toss and catch makes the activity feel like a sporty parlour game, delighting children and adults alike. He turns to face me, and for one terrifying moment I think he's going to kiss me. Instead, just as I'm about to slap him, he leans across and envelops me in a great big hug. I exhale loudly. I needed this. Yes, I'm a willing huggy, leaning further and further into the embrace, my face now buried deep in Brian's overcoat, which stinks no more and no less than I imagined it would. It's then that I realized he isn't hugging me. He's actually just leaning across to rifle through the bin. Remember, to a no-homer, bins are like supermarkets. We're in Gravesend, so it's likely to be more Morrisons than Waitrose, but, and this is lovely writing, beggars literally can't be choosers. With Brian distracted, I wipe away my tears. Not that I was crying particularly, but I wipe them away all the same. I think I hear him say the words, "I've hit the fucking jackpot here," and when he leans away from the bin, he's holding a pack of Jaffa cakes. They're past their best before date, and the chocolate's gone all ashen like E.T. does when he goes all ashen. But Brian doesn't mind. "Thanks for listening," I say. looking around the park, grateful to have found common ground on this piece of common ground. I didn't think anyone would be interested.
Are you kidding me?
Still managing to sound wise through a mouthful of mashed Jaffa.
What's more interesting than how our fathers shape us, and how we use that shape to shape the world? The journey you're going on, Alan. People write books about that.
Yes, and make TV shows. I laugh and tell him about Harvey Kennedy and his golden geese, Portillo Balding Bradbury.
And why not Partridge?
He smiles. I smile and explain that, yes, for a while, honouring my father and making a television programme about it had been a flight of fancy I'd indulged. And yes, I'd gone as far as trumpeting it on BBC One's The One Show. Had he heard of The One Show? He hadn't heard of The One Show. But Harvey Kennedy wasn't contactable, slash lacked honour. So the footsteps of my father's television project was ironically as dead as the very father I was now focused on privately honouring. But by now Brian is on a roll. God, I love him. He seems to think it could easily be formatted up into a 6-part series in which I crisscross the country, recreating intensely personal journeys made by famous historical figures.
Walking in the footsteps of other people's fathers, as he puts it.
Bit sexist, but there you go. He's convinced that with a couple of days shooting, expansive external shots, with judicious use of voiceover, this walk could still be turned into the series opener, describing it, and this is something I'm pretty sure I've never heard a homeless person say before, as proof of concept. He feels very strongly that it's in the same sweet spot as Portillo's Great British Railway Journeys or Canal Walks with Julia Bradbury, and he reminds me that Julia gets wonderfully remunerated. Although instead of saying the words wonderfully remunerated, he just says, Bradbury gets, then takes my phone and types out 3 pound symbols. Pound, pound, pound. I tell him he should be the BBC's commissioning editor for factual entertainment. He laughs, but I'm not even joking right now. Not that the Beeb deserves him. His wisdom would be wasted at Broadcasting House. He should fly himself out to India. I know he has almost no money, but BA do some good deals at this time of year, and Hindu holy men, who are basically just homeless fellas themselves, are widely revered. Maybe he could become one of them. I realise Brian's still talking.
At the very least, you should go see this Kennedy guy. If he said he was interested in your walk, you should follow it up.
Too late, I tell him. Besides, it's the start of a bank holiday weekend, Brian. Now, that won't mean a whole heap to you, but...
Turn up at his door, he suggests, like I do when I miss my kids.
I'm touched by his passion, even though I'm sure he's already told me he doesn't have any kids. And I tell him that if I were 20 years younger, I'd definitely have tried to pitch it. But after Harvey let me down and the whole Backshall mess... No, I tell him, I have different priorities these days, although I'm very tired now and can't recall what they are. Our conversation is at an end, and in a final act of quite staggering kindness, Brian offers me his bed, the bench, and lies down on the grass nearby. Night, Brian.
Sleep well, Alan. Swig of sherry?
Oh, no more drink for me, thanks.
No, I mean his mouthwash.
And with that he gargles the celebrated cooking liquor and blasts it from his mouth into a hedge.
Night-night.
What a guy.